Welcome to Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age, the show designed to help make middle age your prime time of life by defying the notion that once you reach 40, 50, or even 60 years old, your crowning achievements are all behind you. Regardless of whether you're just approaching 40 or are firmly entrenched in your middle years, it's time to launch your very own personal journey toward a joyful and purpose-filled second half of life. Each week, host Roy Richards, an expert on midlife renewal and author of A Midlife Challenge, Wake Up, will discuss the challenges common to middle age and help guide you to a brighter tomorrow. Now, here's Roy.
Well, Happy New Year. As you know, the theme of our program is waking up at midlife to positive change, a take charge attitude, and in control of your own destinies, leading to a joyful, bountiful, and purpose-filled second half of life. And that's a great theme for the start of 2013. There's one problem. Our country's elected leaders need themselves to wake up to the pending financial disaster. We all know that the national debt is now $16 trillion and growing, and our nation's debt crisis can ruin the future retirement for those of us over 45, along with everyone else. Can you imagine what it would be like nearing retirement age in Greece? To start with, we all need some common sense to cut through all the BS and doublespeak that our politicians keep feeding us. When they say $4 trillion deficit reduction over the next 10 years, the real meaning is the deficit will grow by $6 trillion instead of $10 trillion. How about we need a balanced approach? Millions and billionaires must pay their fair share. The truth is, the so-called Buffett rule that was in vogue last spring would reduce 0.5% of the nation's deficit. What about the remaining 99.5%? That could be a problem. How about we will rein in federal government spending, which they always like to say. The facts are, 2012, government receipts of $2.5 trillion are only about $119 billion below what they were in 2007, but the annual outlay has risen from $2.7 trillion to $3.5 trillion. Doesn't sound like we're reining in expenses too well, does it? How about we will do everything we can to protect the middle class? The truth is, inflation and a language economy are eating away at middle class purchasing power. The real average disposable income has declined for four straight years. And think about this. Goods and services that you could have bought for a dollar in 1970 cost $5.86 now. That's pretty frightening when you think about it. And wait until real significant dollar devaluation, runaway inflation, and financial collapse hits. Although it's not a pleasant subject for the start of the new year, you and I need to make some sense out of what this one-plus trillion-dollar a year deficit spending means and how it will impact our wallets, our jobs, and our retirement, not to mention our children and grandchildren. And we have a guest today that will be just the one that can help us understand a little more about this. Our guest today is co-author of the book, The Financial Tsunami, How It Will Affect or Engulf the Country in the Next 10 Years. Hello, Bill and Will, and welcome to our program.
Well, thank you for having us, Roy.
Well, is all this current talk about avoiding the fiscal cliff likely to produce a realistic solution to our nation's debt crisis?
I seriously doubt that the solution is going to be forthcoming in the short term. Even with what's been done recently, it took us 40 years to get into this situation, and it's not going to be fixed overnight. You pointed out that, even with the Buffett rule, we're affecting less than, a half a percent of the total debt. And that's the debt that we talk about, not even the unfunded liability side of the debt, which could be as high as $120 trillion.
Yeah, so that's a scary thing.
It is. It's a very scary thing.
Well, the thing that kills me is all these smoke and mirrors of Capitol Hill's baseline budgeting, which automatically increases spending each year. So the so-called $4 trillion deficit reducing plan may be no reduction at all.
That's correct. I mean, they do like to hide the truth. And it doesn't matter what party we're dealing with. Both parties seem to be relatively inept at this. Not inept at hiding it, but inept at fixing it.
Yeah,
they're very good at being politicians.
Your book demonstrates that the deficit problem has increased with both parties in power, that it's not just a one-party problem by any means, although, the Republicans always seem to claim to have fiscal responsibility. They haven't done much better job at controlling the growth of debt than the Democrats have.
I would agree with that. As you said, in our book, we pointed out that it didn't matter who was in the Senate, who was in the Congress, who was the president. If you had all three owned by one party, it still didn't matter. Over the last 40 years, we have not had a single year of budget surplus. Now, I know a number of your listeners might think that, what about the Clinton surplus?
Yeah, that's
well, you talk about smoke and mirrors. You take $500 billion or $500 billion of Social Security surplus, and you let it flow into the general treasury without an offsetting entry to say we owe it to anyone, and suddenly you have a balanced budget.
Yes, in your book you mention the fallacy of ignoring $5 trillion in intergovernmental debt, which will become public debt and will worsen an already fragile economy.
And what's really interesting about that, if you stop and think about it for a moment, we've been taking this Social Security money, and I do mean take, because an IOU is not something solid that you're going to be able to say, hey, they're really going to pay this back. And if it were, then it would have been in the budget to show that they owed it, and it doesn't show that. But for every dollar that they have been taking from Social Security, it's going to require $2 to offset that when it's needed again, which we now are in a negative situation. We're paying out more in Social Security than we're taking in. So now we're in that situation. So the dollar that we used, that surplus dollar that we used, still is needed. Plus, we have to pay back the dollar that we did use.
Yeah.
So that's the dollar that we have to borrow and the extra dollar we have to borrow to pay back. So for every dollar we pay back, we're actually going to impact the budget by $2.
Ouch. Well, let's talk about the crisis in Medicare and Social Security. I know in the Wall Street Journal, November 27th, they had an opinion article that estimated $86.8 trillion in combined unfunded liability for Social Security, Medicare, and future federal employee retirement benefits, and these don't even show up in these in the $16 trillion deficit or the budget debt we supposedly owe. And the scary thing is, if they talked about including accrued expenses and other federal expenditures, that journal article estimated the Treasury at some point will need $8 trillion a year in tax revenues. And since 2012, tax revenues were around $2.5 trillion. That's about $5.5 trillion short. And the other thing that scared the bejesus out of me, it said if you confiscated all the income from everyone making more than $66,000 a year and all the corporate earnings, you would total about $6.7 trillion, or we'd still be $1.3 trillion short. And, of course, that assumes that everyone keeps working and investing even though they get nothing. So it just doesn't make a lot of sense, does it?
No, the numbers have never added up. And you pointed out that article said 86.6. And Richard Fisher, who's the head of the Federal Reserve in Dallas, and I would think this individual would have some idea of what this number is. He believes it's closer to $120 trillion.
Oh, great. Well, that's a few trillion here and there, right?
it's more than a few trillion.
Yeah.
But the real problem is that, it's been recognized when we wrote the book. Social Security puts out an annual report. And as part of that annual report, they always, whoever's the head of the Social Security, has a little something to say up front. In 2009, a gentleman by the name of Tim Geithner, you might recognize that name.
Yes, I think that name is a little familiar.
And I'm going to quote what Tim wrote. And this was 2009, and I'm going to give you his update in 2012.
Yeah.
Absent policy actions aimed at reforming the key drivers of our structural deficits, healthcare spending and Social Security, the federal government faces unsustainable growth and debt. Unsustainable. The longer the action to deal with the federal government's long-term fiscal outlook is delayed, the greater the risk that the eventual changes will be disruptive and destabilizing.
Yes.
That was in 2009.
Yes.
And that's from the president's own man.
Yes.
What does he have to say in 2012? He says that both Medicare and Social Security cannot sustain projected long-run program costs under current scheduling financing, and legislative modifications are necessary to avoid disruptive consequences for beneficiaries and taxpayers.
And yet his own party keeps saying that they're not going to do anything to lessen the future Social Security benefits for anyone.
Right. His boss is saying
yes.
that. So he's telling his boss it's not sustainable, but his boss is saying, we're going to ignore that. Let's concentrate on this, you know, the 5% of
yes.
the taxpayers of the country, who, by the way, pay about 55% of the taxes. Let's concentrate on them because that's going to have the biggest impact.
And
but
they're,
even if
of course, also the ones that tend to drive the economy through investment
right.
and taking risks.
But even if we do that, you know, we spend on an average $10 million a minute in this country.
Wow.
And if you were to take the amount of money that would be generated by taxing the rich, the 250,000 and up, that money would last about 5.5 days, and it's certainly not going to help balance the budget.
No.
So
finding people as rich because they make 250,000 a year is a bit of a stretch in these times, especially if you live in New York or San Francisco or some of those high-cost areas.
So we need to find a way to approach Social Security and Medicare. Everyone says it. I don't know why the parties can't agree to it. Well, one party is certainly moving in that direction.
Yeah.
But means-based testing for Social Security. And
yeah.
I realize, you know, we've paid in. But you know what? If I'm sitting on a couple of million dollars in retirement funds, do I really need, you know, $2,000 extra a month to
no,
make my?
No, you know, that's exactly how I feel. I would much rather give up my entire Social Security if I can protect my portfolio and see it grow, and all my retirement savings and investments that I put aside for years aren't endangered by rampant inflation or the other negative consequences, a prolonged recession that will be caused by this excess deficit spending we're doing.
And I think that's what most folks are missing, Roy. And that's that if we default, you know, hyperinflation is going to strike. There's
yeah.
you know, look at Argentina, 200% inflation, and you may be sitting on a very nice nest egg, and you think this is enough to see me through. But if we have hyperinflation, I don't know about you, but I'm a whole lot more conservative than what I was.
Yeah.
So I'm in things that are going to produce income and are a bit more stable.
Yeah.
And in hyperinflation, those things are going to get left behind.
No, and here's what's so scary. You know, you listen to these ads on the radio and TV, they say, well, buy gold and silver, precious metals, and this kind of thing is the only solution. But, you know, if the country's gone to hell in a handbasket and there are riots on the street and 200% inflation like you talk about, just because you're sitting on some gold and silver isn't going to make the quality of life that great. And furthermore, gold and silver and precious metals, even commodities, pay no interest or dividends, so you're receiving no monies coming in to fund your lifestyle and retirement or whatever. And So it might be great that you have something that's worth more in terms of dollars, but it isn't really funding your lifestyle.
That's
so
true.
I don't know. And you mentioned somewhere in the book that the problem is, you know, we pass these mandates that we don't fully understand how much they're going to cost, and then they become the point where they can't be repealed and they can't be funded. And not the greatest of timing. We've got Obamacare ready to kick in fully in 2014. How much additional debt is that going to put on us?
Well, it's very difficult to really assess that. CBO looked at it a couple of times, and a lot of that falls back to Congress, because the CBO is an arm of Congress. And they can only work with what they're given.
Yes.
And when this Obamacare was being put forth, they were given certain I'm losing the word here, but
yeah, I know what you're talking about. They were given various assumptions to work with.
Assumptions. I'm sorry. Yeah. They were given assumptions, and those assumptions weren't valid.
Yeah.
It's very simple. I mean, this is the way Congress plays their games. We will assume that we're going to have tax or reductions in payments to physicians.
Yes.
Well, but we're not going to put anything in place to actually make those reductions.
No,
but
the reductions are always well into the future. The expenses are now.
Right, right. And again, that's our politicians playing the games.
And then when every year they do some last-minute finagling to get rid of those reductions to the physicians, so that savings never comes through.
That's correct. And the problems continue to perpetuate. And like with Obamacare, we are going to see that instead of this being a cost reduction overall, this is going to probably be a much higher cost to each individual as well as to the government.
Yes, look at every other program the government's instituted. they never stay within budget.
I do recall one of my favorite cartoons is when the government broke up AT&T, and it said the breakup of AT&T brought to you by the government, the same people who brought the railroads to their knees.
And so, now is managing the Postal Service.
Right, and managing it into, I'm not even sure, but they're using the Postal Service's pension fund as well. So, you know, don't feel bad if you're a postal worker and look at Social Security as being something that you're not going to be able to get because you're a postal worker. They've got your money too, so you're at risk as well.
Well, at this
as well as every federal employee.
We've talked a lot about the negatives. At this point, are there any feasible solutions to turning around this decades of fiscal irresponsibility? Is there any hope that we can do something about it?
Well, as we pointed out in the book, we've taken over 40 years to get here, and it's not going to happen overnight.
No, of course.
But the first thing is getting a real tax reform. You know, we're talking about that that 5% that we wanted.
Yes.
We want to get their taxes. But let's be realistic about this. Let's get that 5% and everybody else. Let's look at the tax code and rework it such that we're able to support what we're doing. And let's balance the budget. How long can we go without balancing a budget? And the sad part about this, and my best analogy, is that the government pays its debt by borrowing money to pay the debt.
Yes, they do.
Now that's like us paying our mortgage with a credit card.
Yes, it is.
And when the mortgage comes due again, you just get a new credit card, and you put the mortgage on that credit card, and you never pay down the principal.
Yes,
and that's what our government is doing. They're not paying down a principal.
Back in my life where I was, my family was doing that, and that's certainly not a good thing to be doing, paying one credit card by taking advances on another credit card or getting a new credit card. It just doesn't work.
But Yeah, but that's what our government is doing. I mean, it's if we were to do that in our everyday life, you know, people would look at us and say, are you crazy?
Yeah.
But the government does it, and it's okay. I don't understand why that's okay. Why can't we live within our means?
How do we get through to the average American that this debt crisis impacts them? You know, I read recently that especially younger people are more interested in who's going to win American Idol than they are in really figuring out and listening to problems about the debt that the country faces. And I just don't, and you know, everyone, we had this Tea Party uprising in 2010, and then we turn around 2 years later and reelect just about the same cast of characters that has given us $5 trillion in additional debt over 5 years or 4 years. How do we get the attention of people so that they really rise up and force some action on Washington?
Well, I'm not sure how to do that.
I guess if we could retire and you know, not worry so much about it.
Well, I think in retirement we're going to worry even more if we look back and look at the people who are going to be left in charge, and those are the young people who seem to be more interested in American Idol.
Yes.
But, you know, we have to have some faith here, and that's that at some point in time, and hopefully it won't be, we won't experience things like they're experiencing in Greece, but I'm afraid that's what we will see.
Yeah.
If things do go bad, if we ever default, I believe that you know, we'll see unbelievable things happening again, much like we saw back in the late 60s, early 70s.
Yes.
But no longer over race, and it'll be over, you know, where's my piece of the pie?
Yeah. Everyone
well,
is for fiscal restraint, so long as it doesn't impact them. That's a sad point.
Oh, yeah.
And as you point out in your book, everyone is going to have to put skin in the game. And that's
right.
Why, like you say, we need some tax reform that affects everybody. But in addition to tax reform, we've got to rein in this spending. And I just don't know how to do that. But
well, the first thing is, I think, is to, you know, I think we can get the politicians' attentions.
Yes.
But we're not doing it. Like you say, people aren't spending the time to understand what the situations are. They think that these politicians are going to fix the problem. But they're the people who got us here.
Yeah.
So how are they going to fix it? So, you know, it's when you need to be in touch with your politician. I know that my local congressman here in Florida is Dan Webster. And I let him know what I'm feeling, and I'm very specific. I'm not saying things like, you know, fix this or fix this. I am telling him that I am concerned that the tax code is no longer viable, and I would like for him to work towards improving that. So you need to be specific with your legislators. Let them know what it is that you're looking for. Let them know what you want. Because if they hear from one voice, you're the voice of thousands. So one voice is a very, very significant voice. So we've got to let our politicians know where we want to take this country.
Yes, I was very happy to see in the December 5th Wall Street Journal, an organization called Coalition for Fiscal and National Security placed a full-page ad pleading for fiscal responsibility, and it included bipartisan leaders like Madeleine Albright, Paul Volcker, you know, Zygmunt Brzezinski from way back in the Carter era, Henry Kissinger and George Shultz. I mean, they're bipartisan, and if people like that perhaps can have some influence. But then again, we had the Simpson-Bowles Commission, which had some good ideas, and they seem to be totally ignored in the conclusions from that study. So I don't know what it will take.
Well, I don't know either.
Let's get
down to where
the rubber meets the road. If you've been diligently in saving for retirement, if the problem is not solved soon, how is this debt crisis likely to impact you? That's the scary part.
Well, I know that that I'm in that situation. I'm at retirement, And and I look at this, and I am very, very concerned that the monies that I have accumulated will not last me for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And I do not believe that the federal government is going to be there to help me.
No.
As I, you know, my dad is 96. I can only think that, you know, I'm going to be 96 or older. And I, based on my calculations, I can do that right now.
Yeah.
But if inflation hits, if, you know, the government cuts back if taxes are increased, I don't have a chance. I'll be on the public dole at some point in time, or out in the street.
And that's the problem, is there may not be any dole to be doled out if we don't get some responsibility now.
And it's a shame that you know, that our elderly aren't being taken more seriously by the younger generation.
Well, what's even more a shame is that we're lucky somewhat in our late middle age or older that we won't be around when perhaps a lot of the worst of this happens, when the young people, I don't know what they're going to be faced with, but people in their 20s or 30s, given the path that the government is on and the expenditures. Well, certainly a start is for people to get a hold of your book, which I think, you know, I previewed a little of it, and it has a lot of common sense ideas, and that would certainly be a starting place. And then if we all band together as people of middle age, responsible adults, and really make known to Congress that we want things, and to the president, that we want things changed, and we want it done now, not later, how do they get a hold of your book?
Well, they can go to our website, www.thefinancialtsunami.com. That's TSUNAMI.com. And we did have a benefactor who bought a number of books. We probably have only another couple hundred left.
Oh.
He bought about 5,000 books.
Oh, that's great.
And we will ship them to you. Unfortunately, we don't ship them. Somebody else does. And there is a shipping and handling on it at $5.90.
Oh.
But the book is free. Like I said, there's probably another couple hundred left to ship out.
Oh, that's great. Of course, they can go to Amazon.com, but they have to pay for it there.
Right. And even if you get it on Kindle, you'll find that the shipping and handling will be less than the Kindle edition.
Yeah, that's very inexpensive. And that, once again, your website
is
www.
Appreciate that benefactor. So.
www.thefinancialtsunami.com. And this is a rather disturbing subject for the beginning of the year, but it's something we all need to address, and we need to get after Washington to take care of now. And we thank you so much, Will, for being on our program today. Well, as we begin the new year, it's as good a time as any to reflect upon our job and our career. I remember jobs where I dreaded returning to work after New Year's Day. Remember the same old grind, holiday season's over, the shortest, coldest day of the year, if you live in the north anyway, no prospect for positive change in the new year, and a long, long way until summer vacation. Does it feel like Monday morning at your workplace all week long? Does going to work feel like torture? Well, on several prior shows, we've talked about Plan B, starting your own business or finding a new job at midlife, but maybe you really don't want to quit. What if you could make things better right where you are, make your present workplace more enjoyable? Our second guest today says you can learn to love your work without quitting. Whether you're CEO, department manager, or frontline staff, you can turn things around. Our guest is Garth S. Johns. He's a former chief executive, and he's now a sought-after human resources consultant. And he's author of his latest book, is Quit Your Job, Enjoy Your Work. Sounds like a pretty good idea. Hello, Garth, and welcome to our program.
Hello there, Ryan. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thanks. Early in your book, you make the statement that I wholeheartedly endorse, work should be as natural as play. Boy, that would sure be great. How do you make things challenging yet enjoyable for your subordinates if you're a leader and up in top management?
Well, you know, one of the things that, Roy, that I think we get too caught up in sometimes is we've worked hard, we got to be the boss, the manager, supervisor, executive director, CEO, whatever it is, and now we need to prove that we're in charge.
Yeah.
So we kind of forget where we came from. And one of the things that I think we so often forget is that, as I've noted in the book, everyone we meet is facing some kind of a challenge. So we have to remember that we're dealing with individuals, no matter where we are. And I hate the term human resources, to tell you the truth, because
yeah,
it makes
too.
It sound like it's a capital resource or a financial resource or something else. These are people we're dealing with. So as a manager, all I ask people to do is remember that they're people you're dealing with.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea. Well, in your book, you distinguish between the concepts of manager and leader, and please explain the distinction and how those with a manager's title can become leaders, and they should become leaders.
Well, the distinction is really fairly simple. As a manager, you have certain functions to perform that you have to plan, organize, implement, delegate, control, measure, whatever those things are. You submit
yeah.
your budget, you hire people, and so on and so forth. Those are functions that you perform. But as a leader, your role is really to inspire other people. That's what you should be doing. And I talk about that in another book I've done, but I won't dwell on that. But the importance is that you inspire others. And the example I give, the best metaphor really, is that of an orchestra conductor.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, the role of a conductor is really to make everyone else around him or her sound better. And the
yeah.
question I often ask is, who's the only member of the orchestra that doesn't make a sound?
Yeah.
Is the conductor. Who's the leader? The conductor.
Unless he's swearing at the orchestra.
yeah. Well, yeah, I'm assuming they're playing reasonably well. So
yeah.
we don't want to encourage the swearing at the orchestra either, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I love the way they wave around like that. I never could figure out how they do that.
you missed your Music 101 class, that's all.
Yeah, I guess so. No, a leader is one that, and so many times a person seems to assume that just because they have a title, be it manager, CEO, or whatever, that they naturally have the right to lead the people in the direction they want, and they're not really leading at all just because they have a title.
That's right. That's right. And, I shouldn't be promoting other people's works here, but Robin Sharma has recently put out a book called The Leader Who Had No Title, and that's exactly what, you know, both he and I promote.
Yeah. Well, let's move on down to and this is where I get frustrated from my own personal experience. Let's say you're someone down in the ranks, someone that actually makes the company work, and you don't
yep.
have a formal title. And in your book, you note that anyone can lead, and you don't need a title to do so. But how do you go about leading from the rear, in effect? Well, not from the rear, but from down in the ranks. If you have a boss that, you know, you don't communicate with that well, or doesn't communicate that well with you, and you have some ideas, how do you sell them up and make your job fun for you and for your coworkers?
Well, I think it so much boils down to simple attitude. I'm not so naive to believe everything's perfect. I know
mm-hmm.
I've had similar experiences as what you've had, and not every boss is going to be as open-minded and progressive as what I think they should be. And that's
yeah.
part of my lot in life, is try and convince them all to change their attitude and their approach. But having said that, you know, the example I use, I recently did some work, an operational review for an organization, and one of the people I had to talk to was the receptionist. And she came in to talk to me, to meet with me about different things. And first thing she said is, "Hi, I think her name was Jennifer, and I'm just the receptionist." Well, that sort of stuff drives me nuts. I said,
yeah.
So I said to her, "Yes, okay, you're just the receptionist. Now, who's the first person when people call in that they talk to?" Well, she says,
exactly.
"Me." And I said, if they walk in, where we were sitting, we could see her workstation. And I said, when they walk in those front doors, who's the first face they see? as well as mine. I said, there's no more important function in the entire organization than yours right now, because that's
exactly
the first impression that'll count. So when I say attitude, everyone has to remember that their job is important, no matter what it is.
Yeah.
The floor sweeper's job is important. They're critical importance. If they weren't, you and I both know that managers or CEOs or somebody's going to get rid of them.
Yeah,
but
and
know
can
that
you
job,
imagine,
you're important.
Can you imagine walking into a company where the receptionist is surly and doesn't smile at you and acts like you don't even matter?
Absolutely.
What kind of an impression you would get of that company, or if the floors are all dirty with
absolutely,
and
I think just unfortunately people just forget about the importance of some of those functions, and everyone, it becomes a total team where everyone contributes to the total team effort.
Yeah, and if you're always pleasant and refused, even when your boss is having a bad day, if you're pleasant and don't argue back with that boss and try to help out however you can, after a while I would think it's going to rub off and also on your coworkers.
It does, and that's kind of the other element I think I mentioned in there, and that is even if you don't have those functions where you connect directly with the customer or the client, the role that lots of people play, and I've seen this too, is just the ordinary person in the organization, they're working on the line or they're a clerk somewhere.
Yeah.
Just by virtue of how they conduct themselves, they can bring everybody else around them up a level. They're
That's
happy,
exactly
they're cheerful,
right.
They're positive, and so on and so forth. They can perform an incredible leadership function.
Yeah, if the person at the next desk is always positive and smiles a lot, and I'm somebody that deals with customers, if I'm around that person, I'm going to be a lot more pleasant with the customers.
That's
sure.
Right. That's right. I remember I had an admin assistant once when I was a vice president in an organization, and I would say it's fair to say that she was not technically the best candidate we ever saw, but with her positive attitude and her excellent relations with everyone she came into contact with, I wouldn't trade her for all the tea in China.
Yeah, and that's definitely what let's all set as an objective for 2013, to bring positive outlook and make that work a place that there's no reason why we can't have fun while we're earning a living. Most of us have to do that, and may not be as great as going out on the golf links or something, but it can be a place that you
depends on my score for that day.
Yeah, that's true. That can be pretty unpleasant too, but we can make it so that it isn't something that we dread doing, and so that the early days of January are not the pits like they always used to be.
That's right. Keep the glass half full.
Yeah, and how can someone obtain your book?
The easiest way is to just check out my website, www.garthjohns.com, and connect with me, and I'll get one to you.
And you also do some consulting services, I know, for people that are interested transforming their workplace. And just remember, it's Garth Brooks for country music and Garth Johns for inspiration for your workplace. And
that's right.
I've
yet to meet Garth Brooks, but I'd be happy to do so someday.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us, and Happy New Year to you and to all the listeners.
My pleasure, and best of 2013 to all of you.
You've been listening to Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age, hosted by Roy Richards, an expert on midlife renewal and author of both A Midlife Challenge, Wake Up, and Wake Up, Captain and Crew, Restart Your Engines. You can learn more about Roy and his Middle Age Renewal Training System by visiting his website, middleagerenewal.com.